Hello and welcome to Built to Go, a van life podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Wagg, coming to you from the College of Curiosity. This time it's episode 247, and we're going to talk about boondocking. That's right, we're going to tell you how to get out there and avoid all those hookups and save a whole bunch of money until you run out of stuff. We'll also talk about a hanging safe. This is a whole new concept to me. We will visit a place that might have some of your luggage in it, and we'll have a story about a fire that's a little too close to home. Hello, everyone. Thanks for joining me here once again. It's always nice to imagine your friendly faces and voices and stuff. I mean, honestly, it actually feels like I'm just talking into the void here, but folks, you are the void, and you're why I'm here. So today is one of those coffee days. You know, some days are like whiskey days, and some days are coffee days. If you partake of either of those, I partake of both. And today's a coffee day, so cheers. This is to you. Okay. Let's dive right in here. So boondocking. Boondocking, there's many terms for this all around the world. Everyone has their own different terms. And here are just some. I'm just using Word Hippo to find some here. So camping. Okay, yeah. Go bush. Hey, we're going to go bush. I haven't heard that one before. I'll bet that's Australian. Maybe some of you Australians can let me know. I've never heard that before. Another one is go off grid. Primitive camping, roughing it, sleeping rough, which I typically associate with just sleeping outside without anything, wild camping, which I associate with the UK, and dry camping. Whatever you want to call it, I'm going to use the term boondocking. And it's basically using your rig without being in a campground, without hooking up to anything. You are completely self-contained. And that is my default when I think about van life. To me, one of the big differences between van life and RV life is that RVs are much more dependent on hookups than vans. I believe that when most people build their vans, they have boondocking in mind. Now, of course, there's exceptions. I mean, nothing is absolute. But just as a way to illustrate my point, I have an Airstream trailer and I have a van. My van has 300 watts of solar on the roof and 200 watts of battery, because that's a pretty good amount for some boondocking. My Airstream has, I think, 150 watts of solar and like 85 amp hours of battery. And it uses a lot more power than my van, I can tell you that. I mean, it's a much bigger vehicle with more stuff in it. And so the reason that is that the solar and the battery in the Airstream are just there for when you're in between campsites. Like if you're going to go to a park and bring your trailer and, you know, you have enough there to make lunch or whatever. There's enough battery power to run the heater for a while, that kind of thing. But my van, I don't ever have to be hooked up in a campground. In fact, my current van, I have never, ever hooked up. At all, in any way. My current van, the entire time I've had it, and it's a 2011 Sprinter 144 that was an ambulance and is now a camper. Yeah, I had a hookup built into it. It has an electric hookup, because all ambulances do. I've never plugged it in. I've never needed to. That 300 watts of solar and that 200 amp hours of battery has always been plenty. I've never run out of battery the way I camp. So, to me, that's the default. I figured that's what most people are doing. But I don't think I've actually ever talked about it. So this is a decision you should make before you build your rig. And that is based on, like, what are you going to do with your rig? There are definitely cases where you would want to build out your rig where you're always going to have hookups. And hookups are great, by the way. I'm not saying you shouldn't use hookups. If you have access to hookups, that's wonderful. The problem is they cost money, and they're only in certain places. So there's one exception to this, and I know people who do this fairly regularly, and they do what's called mooch docking. Mooch docking isn't going to a campground. It's basically going to someone's house and borrowing an extension cord or a garden hose or something like that. And, you know, that's quote-unquote free, whatever your arrangement is with your friend. And if you're in a situation where you can take advantage of that, it does make sense to put some effort into having your rig be able to take advantage of hookups. But if your rig is capable of taking care of itself, if it is a boondocking rig, You don't need that. I mean, so case in point, right? I have my van. It's a boondock rig, okay? This thing is ready wherever I take it. It's all set. I don't need to hook up at all. And I frequently stop at this free campground in Aurora, Nebraska, that's right off of I-80. It's Streeter Park in Aurora, Nebraska, if you've not heard me talk about this before, has a campground with full hookups, even a dump station and flush toilets, too. That's completely free. Anybody can stay there for up to 4 days. It is a great place to stop if you're driving cross-country on I-80. And Aurora, Nebraska has all kinds of cool stuff in it. And I've probably talked about it too much, but anyway, I will continue to because I'm so amazed that this thing exists. But when I pull my rig in there, I don't use the hookups. I mean, I'll get fresh water and replenish my tanks, but I don't plug in. I don't have a need to. The actual effort of plugging in my rig isn't worth it. My batteries are always charged. I have a battery-to-battery charger, so while I'm driving, that charges the batteries, and then my 300 watts of solar does a fine job all the... And to me, this is the way to be. I am completely free. I can go anywhere that I won't get arrested with my vehicle and be completely comfortable. What do you want to focus on if you want your rig to be boondock capable? There's a few concerns here. One big one is if you're going to have power, and you know, you don't actually have to have big batteries. You can just have a power station that you can recharge with a cigarette lighter plug or portable solar or something like that. But the problem remains the same. You have to have a way to charge those batteries. And that's not necessarily easy. I mean, like I said, I've got the 300 watts of solar on the roof and the battery-to-battery charger. That's a few hundred dollars worth of stuff. You have to install it. It's kind of a pain, but I'm very glad that I did. If I didn't have that much money and time, or if I had a no-build, that would be trickier. So a boondocking no-build rig is going to be something much more like camping, and your power should be more along the USB side of things. You know, we're using USB lighting, maybe, which uses a lot less power, and it'll last longer off your power station, etc. And you would probably just give up on any high power electrical demands like cooking. Forget air conditioning. Just forget air conditioning. We're not even going to talk about that. Maybe we'll talk about that as we get closer to summer, but not today. And for heat, you know, if you have a diesel heater, for example, yes, you will want to be able to recharge that because those things draw a lot of amperage when they first start, and then they use amperage all night long. So that's the thing with boondocking. You've got to have a way to replenish the things you're using. So the first one you have to worry about is how you're going to keep your batteries charged. Make sure you have a solution for that. And I'm not going to go through them here because it'll be way too long. The next thing you have to worry about, and this one in my experience, is the limiting factor on how long I can boondock. I run out of water before anything else. Water is like, that's when I need to go. And that's just how it is. Water is heavy and it takes up space and you are limited by what you can carry. Even if you have a giant water tank, well, think about how much space a 40-gallon water tank takes, and then how many gallons of water are you going to use per day? Depending on how you bathe and how you do dishes and how you cook, maybe you can get away with as little as 1 gallon a day, maybe 10 gallons a day, but you can see the problem there. When you get up in the 10 gallons a day range, which is the minimum you could possibly use, I think, if you were doing showers every day, for example, well, you're limited to 4 days. So that's how long you can be out. You can only be out 4 days until you get more water. My solution for this, and I like this solution, is that my water in my van runs off of jerry cans. So, you know, those big 6 gallon or 5 gallon containers like from World War II movies. I have one of those that's filled with water, and I have an electric pump that's hooked up to a hose that goes through the top of that can. These cans, actually, the ones you get from Walmart, they're pretty good. They're kind of a bluish gray color. They have a spout that if you turn the spout upside down, it'll go right into the jerry can, and then a hose will fit fairly snugly right in there. And that's what I do. I haven't had any problems with it leaking or anything like that. But basically, I carry two of those. And I put one in the back as storage and new supply of water, you know, when I run out. And then I have one that's actually hooked up to the system. But I'm limited by that. So I can go a few days without water. I can probably go a week without water. And depending on where I am and what kind of camping I'm doing, I could possibly stretch that. But when I, say, go to Rocky Mountain Star Stair, which I'm not going to be able to go to this year, I'm very sad about, I use a lot more water because I am cooking and cleaning and everything for every single meal. Whereas if I'm driving across the country and I'm trying to make time, I might just grab some fast food for lunch or something, which actually saves water. Fast food saves water. There's a new one. So make sure you have a plan for water. That's a huge one. Now, there are ways to conserve water. There are recirculating showers. I'm not a great big fan of this idea. The concept is that you will take a shower and then the water will go through a bunch of filters, maybe even a UV filter, and then you can keep using the water. And this is designed to save water, but mostly it's designed so that you can take a longer shower. So let's say it uses 5 gallons. But you can use that 5 gallons over and over again, so you can get the effect of having a 20-gallon shower. It sounds great, right? But it's complicated, and the stuff takes up a lot of space, and then you've got cartridges you need to replace, and there's like 30 different places where these things can leak. And having watched videos on people who have put these in their rigs, they all seem problematic. So I am not a big fan of that idea. I think it's just too much. So, water. Make sure you have a solution for water. Now, can you get water from streams and rivers and something like that? Absolutely. Absolutely. You can filter that water a number of different ways. As a side note, I always travel with a Life Straw. This is the original Life Straw. That's this plastic tube that you can basically stick in a muddy water puddle and drink the water through it. It's kind of amazing how these things work. You have to be careful. They don't filter everything. You cannot drink your own pee with these things. The videos of people trying that are pretty hilarious. But if you had a river or a lake that looked relatively clean, absolutely you could get fresh water from that with one of these things. But that's just for emergencies and it's just for drinking. There are larger ones where you can get like a bucket of water and dump it into this thing. It'll filter over time. If you are in a situation where you're going to be camped for like a week next to a river or something, it might be good to look at those. But I highly recommend this system that I've done, I know a lot of other people done, which is that the main bulk of the water in your boondocking van is not for drinking. You could drink it if you have to. I always put a little bit of bleach in that water, and that does an amazing job of keeping anything growing in there. I'm not as rigorous about that water as I am about the water I drink. So I have this bulk water that's used for washing me and washing dishes, and yes, I'll brush my teeth with that water because I'm not swallowing that. But the water I drink actually is in a separate container, and that water always comes from what I call a known good source, either a public utility tap, or sometimes I'll buy water if that's the thing that makes sense at that time. So water is the really biggest problem boondocking. Another issue, and this is a trickier one to solve, is temperature control. You don't have a lot of energy to use when you're boondocking, so what's the best way to keep the temperature livable? Well, the first best way is to camp during temperate seasons. Go high and north in the summer and low and south in the winter, if you can. But it's easier to stay warm than it is to stay cool. So if you have a choice, lean towards the cool side. A blanket will keep you warm if it's 50 degrees and it doesn't take any power. But if it starts getting above 90, 100 degrees, there's very little you can do in a boondocking rig to keep the temperature cold. There, again, I don't want to talk about AC, but yes, if you invest thousands of dollars into your rig, you can have AC that runs off the batteries, but it's many thousands of dollars, and then you will always, always, always be panicking about your capacity because you have to recharge that somehow. So maybe you have 1,000 watts of solar on your roof, if your roof is even big enough for that. These are considerations to have when boondocking, and I like boondocking. I think it is the best way to go. I love having a van that I can just hop in, I can go anywhere, and I know I have a comfortable place to sleep at night. I've got a bathroom if I have to use that. I've got a place to cook, I've got a place to sleep, I've got entertainment, I've got basically everything I need to live in one place, and I can take that place wherever I go. So, if you are building out a van, think about how you're going to use the van and then build it out appropriately. And remember that if you build a boondocking rig, You can still use hookups. You just don't use them the same way. You can run an extension cord through the window or through the door, just being careful not to pinch it. That's fine. Or you can make just a little hole to stick the end of the extension cord in. You don't have to put in a plug. And you never have to hook water up. You can always just refill the containers you have. Special thanks to Anita and Kent for helping to buy me some diesel at buymeacoffee.com/built2go. That's 2 T's, not 3, not 1. Because of Anita and Kent and all the people who donate every month, there are no ads in this podcast, and that makes things a little bit happier. And we could use a little bit happier right about now. If you would like to help out, go ahead and visit buymeacoffee.com/built2go. And I will appreciate it, and so will everybody else. Van life news. Okay, folks, I'm going to take a stab at this. Everything is so crazy that it seems like any news I could report on is going to change in a few minutes. So I'm just taking a stab at this because I do like the news feature. I would like to keep doing the news feature. Some of the stuff is good info, but right now it's really hard to predict what's going to happen in the next few months. So here are some things I picked up. This one could be a very important thing for some of you. South Dakota is looking at changing their residency status. So for years, South Dakota was the state that you could live in if you didn't live anywhere, meaning that if you were somebody who was traveling full-time in your rig and you needed to declare a state of residence, you could declare it to be South Dakota, and you didn't actually have to go there, or you had to go there one day a year, or something very limited. I actually don't know what the current restrictions are, but South Dakota is a great state for this. There's no income tax. It was just a simple place to get a license plate on your car and have nobody hassle you. But they're looking to change that. There's a bill now that wants to change that so that you will have to live there for 30 consecutive days every year to be a South Dakota resident. Now, South Dakota has lots of cool stuff. Maybe you could go hang out in the Badlands 30 days every year, you know, whatever. But there's a catch. You can't just be in the state. You have to be at an address. You have to be at the address of record. And that's a problem because a lot of people who use South Dakota as a residency use a mailing service, and then they're just like a P.O. box, or sometimes they'll have a street address, but it isn't really one. It's like a building that has 800 street addresses, and all the mail goes there, and then the company sorts it and forwards you via email or whatever, which are great. Those mailing services are great. But this legislation, if it passes, is basically going to take South Dakota off the list of good places if you are trying to live everywhere all at once. So I have a link in the show notes about that. It's from RV Miles. I mentioned RV Miles before. RV Miles is a great source for news about RVing. And of course, a lot of that news bleeds over into van life. So I check it often. If you're looking to have a state that you're never going to go to, Texas might be a better bet right now. Another big thing, and it's pretty hard to avoid this one, is the National Park Service in the U.S. is in chaos right now. Executive orders have come down. They've fired all the probationary staff. It's very complicated, and I don't want to get into it too much. But basically, the national parks don't know what they're going to do this summer. They know they're understaffed. And some of them might just have to close, or they might have to at least close the bathrooms. If you have reservations, they're being canceled. We just don't know. This summer travel, at least by RV and van in the summer in the U.S., is going to be crazy. Because if all these national parks suddenly can't have people camping there anymore, well, then all the private parks, the private campgrounds, are going to have all those people trying to get there. It's going to be nearly impossible to find a campground. So who knows? Maybe this will all get fixed in a week and something will come through. We have no idea. But if you're trying to plan your summer, and maybe this was the year you were going to visit every national park, well, be prepared. This is going to be a challenge, and I'm going to keep saying the same thing. Flexibility is your best friend when it comes to travel. The last thing is fuel prices. Now, fuel prices matter, right? So right now, fuel prices are a little bit lower than they were this time last year. Now, summer's coming. I know it doesn't feel like it in much of the country. I know some of you are under feet of snow. But summer is coming in the sense that they're starting to ramp up the summer blends of fuel. and that can change prices. This year, according to what AAA says, it doesn't look like it's going to change them that much. But boy, there are wild fluctuations all over the country. Miami's having huge drops in gas prices. Wisconsin gas is going up, and it's crazy all over the place. So I'll have a link here to just a whole bunch of different things about gas prices. According to AAA, cheapest places to buy gas, still the Central South, you know, Texas over to Alabama, and then up to, like, Tennessee. That's the cheapest place to buy gas in the country. Most expensive places are the entire West Coast, including New Mexico. That whole area is the most expensive gas. Midwest is about average, with the exception of Illinois. Lucky me, Illinois is also kind of like the West Coast, although not quite as bad. New England is a little bit high, and Florida is a standout for high gas prices in that region. So if you want to save money on fuel, you're going to have your best bet visiting the Central South of the United States. You know, have you been to Arkansas? Did you know you can mine for diamonds in Arkansas legally, and any diamond you find is free? Yeah, that's a thing you can do. So maybe Arkansas is a place you want to look at this summer if you're trying to save money. Tech Talk. So I mentioned USB lights in the boondocking thing. Yeah, we've reached the point where you can power all the lights in your rig with USB. Now, in the 5 years or so since I started this podcast, I've always thought that 12-volt LED lights were the thing to do. You've got a 12-volt battery, and why not? But you know, there is a case to be made for USB lights. So, in short, USB, Universal Serial Bus, was designed as a way to transmit data between two computers. That was what it was designed to do. It was supposed to replace serial ports way back in the day. And they had the brilliant idea of giving it a little bit of power. So serial ports don't produce any power, but Universal Serial Bus, USB, does. And then when you say you wanted to hook up something, you could have a little bit of power to power that device, like, say, a camera. You could hook a camera up USB, and the power that comes out of the USB would, you know, be enough for the camera. And then cell phones happened. And I believe it was Apple was the first one to say, hey, we could have people charge their phones with USB. And that changed everything, because then there was a lot more need for the power part. In fact, these days, USB is probably thought of more as power than as a way to transmit data. And that power has gotten more and more and more. And then that led to PD, which is power delivery. And heck, my MacBook Pro now is sitting on my desk charging with a USB cable. That means that you can power lights with LED. And there are some advantages. They tend to be very, very inexpensive. USB lights are not expensive. And they have this kind of a fun thing where you can buy these boxes that have a bunch of USB ports on them, and they have switches. So you could actually buy these. I've seen them mostly in 5 switches. And so you buy this box, it plugs into your USB power source, whether that be your Jackery or something you've installed on your 12-volt battery, whatever. And then 5 USB leads come out of that, and each one of those can go to lights, and then you've got the buttons, and you can turn off all the lights. So for basically maybe 30, 40, 50 bucks, you can have all your lighting done in a modest build just with USB, and you can power that off of anything that gives off USB. You could power it off your computer. You could even power it off your phone, depending. Now, of course, if you do that, it's going to draw power from those devices, but you could just do it all with a power bank, a 20,000 milliamp hour battery. Those are like 15 or 20 bucks these days. Definitely give you enough light all night. And it's also a good thing to think of when you want light in a special place that is tricky. You know, if you have like an under cabinet or something like that, and you're going to have trouble getting the wires, well, USB could possibly work there. The other thing is that there's a lot of portable USB lights, and I featured them on here a few times, but the portable USB lights are great if you're doing some kind of a no build, because you could literally just have one USB chargeable power light source in your rig and just move it to where you need it, and that would be 10 bucks or something. It wouldn't be very much. So we have officially entered the age where USB lighting is something that I think is completely reasonable for your rig, especially if you're down towards the no build range of things. If you're building out a $100,000 adventure rig, yeah, you might as well install the 12-volt lights. You're going to be spending months building the thing out anyway. Make the effort. But it wouldn't be a bad idea to have a few USB lights just like laying around for those times when you want to decorate, or you decide that you actually want some lights in those cabinets underneath that you can't see in, that kind of thing. product review. I saw this in a reel or a TikTok or something. I'd never heard of this before, so I don't have one of these. I've never tried it, but it's an intriguing idea. This is called a hanging safe. So it's a safe, and it hangs. But when I say safe, you're imagining this big metal box that someone's going to blow up with dynamite or something. No, this is a bag. And so imagine this. Imagine you have like a suit jacket and that you cut in half. And that top half of the suit jacket is actually a bag. And it's made out of a fireproof, rip-proof material, and it locks. And so the clever thing here is that in your home or in your van, you can take an old sweatshirt or an old jacket or whatever and hang it on a hanger, but inside that will be this safe, and nobody will know unless they actually take the shirt off the hook. And then if they do find out it's a safe, well, okay, they can steal the whole thing, but they have to get to that point. And if they are trying to get in there without you knowing that anybody's messed with your stuff, well, they can't because it's locked and it's really hard to get into. So this is not the ultimate security thing in the world, but you know, if you're traveling with passports and important papers and things like that, you know, maybe you're crossing borders and you need vaccination papers and whatever, this is a great place to store that stuff, because not only is it less likely to get stolen, it's also somewhat fireproof. Now, my firefighter friends will tell me, and I will tell you, that fireproof does not exist. It's only fire resistance, and fire resistance is a matter of time. And yeah, if your whole rig goes up in a complete conflagration and the whole thing burns down to the ground, this thing probably won't survive. But if you have a minor fire, this will protect things. I've seen ratings for up to 4,000 degrees Fahrenheit. That's about 2,200 degrees Celsius. And, you know, for some cases, it's basically what I'm saying is that this thing is better than nothing. And it's not that expensive. It's like, there's a bunch of different ones, and you can look through and see which one is best for you, but they're under $30. I've owned safes in the past, and I find that one thing they're really good for is that it's just, you know where your stuff is. All your titles, your mortgage papers, whatever important papers you have, you just naturally put them there. I currently don't own a safe, and I've got 3 different filing cabinets, and like if I need a title, I have to remember where I put it, because my wife and I have different filing systems, and we should probably get a safe. So, interesting thing to take a look at. I have a link in the show notes. I think it is a very good idea for someone looking to secure stuff in their vans. And you don't have to get the one that hangs. You could get one that went under your mattress or under your floor mats. It's a protective bag, basically, for anything you put in there. So take a look and see if it's something you could use. Tales from the road. I almost made this the main feature this week, and then I decided against it. But yeah, let me tell you the story. Last week, I did the podcast, and, you know, I'm pretty much done with the drugs at this point. I'm not taking any more opioids, but there's a lasting effect. My brain's not really where it should be entirely, and I'm trying to get used to coming back to my office. So I've got an office/studio that I work in. Everything is perfect there, but it's difficult to get in there and to sit with my ankle the way it is. So I'm getting back used to it. And the first day I did this, I sat here and I was trying to motivate myself, and I thought, boy, I really need to get in writing mode. I've got a lot of writing to do. I've got this book to finish. I've got other projects. And I have a candle on my desk, and I light the candle, and that kind of is the signal to my brain, this is writing time, you know? So I start writing. I get most of the stuff done. And then somebody's at the door, which is a major hassle because I can't move very well. And then the cat gets in the plants and all this stuff goes on. And I'm like, I was just frustrated. So I come back in my office and I grab my computer, which I work on a laptop all the time. And I go back to my comfy chair in the living room and I finish working from there. And, you know, okay, I'll try again the next day. And so the next day, I get up in the morning, and then some other thing requires my attention, and I sit in my comfy chair, and I deal with that. And then, you know, I have a little bit of lunch, and I decide to watch a little bit of TV, and then I smell something. And, like, you know, I live in an apartment building, so sometimes I'll smell things, like if somebody burns something or whatever. And, you know, I'm like, oh, yeah, someone's burning lunch, you know. And then I couldn't be sure, but it seemed like the room was a little bit hazy. And I live in a building that was built in 1895, so, you know, that's a little scary. And I'm like, oh, I left the candle burning. Yeah, remember back in the story where I said I left that candle going, you know, kind of like my inspirational candle? I had totally left it burning. So this candle is a cylinder of wax. It's no container. It's just one of those big, tall cylinder candles. You know, it's one, the kind that'll burn for like 40 hours. The thing's huge. And it had some raffia wrapped around it and some beads and a semi-foresty scent or whatever. It was just a candle. But what had happened was the candle had been burning at that point for about 28 hours. And it had dug itself a tunnel and then started working on the walls. And finally, the wall weakened and all the hot paraffin poured out onto my desk, onto my paper notepad, and believe it or not, onto another candle. And it all ignited. When I got to my office, there were 2 or 3 foot flames coming off of my desk. The room was filled with smoke, and there I am in the doorway on a knee scooter that I can barely get to my desk with, saying, "Oops. So, I do have a skill or a talent or whatever. I don't panic very easily. I'm able to look at a situation and take a beat and analyze the situation." And I did. First thing I thought of was, where's the fire extinguisher? And then I found it. It's in the kitchen. Okay, it would take some effort to get to it, but I could do that. And then I figured, do I have time to do anything else? And I estimated that I had about 20 seconds before this was going to get out of control. I also made sure I had my phone with me, because I would need that to call 911 if this didn't. So it was just on my desk. It was on the verge of lighting up the whole room. Fortunately, the melted wax that had dripped off my desk landed on a metal filing cabinet. None of it hit the floor, and that had not ignited yet. But it was about to. There were burning pieces of paper falling and stuff. So first thing I did was I grabbed the notepad, half of which was on fire, and took it to the nearby bathroom, threw it in the sink, and turned the water on. And then immediately took a washcloth, soaked that in water, went back to the desk, and tossed that on the fire. If that had not put out the fire, I would have called 911 and grabbed my fire extinguisher in that order. However, that was enough. I was able to put it out, and everything's fine, other than I'm sitting here at my desk and, like, the corner of the desk is kind of charred and it... anyway, it was a mess, and it smelled bad, and some of my pens burnt and melted. I mean, it was amazing in two ways. First off, it's amazing that it did that much damage, but on the other hand, it's amazing that it didn't do any more damage. I was the luckiest person in the world that day, because if I had been asleep, or if I hadn't been home, or, I mean, there's so many ifs, ands, or buts. It was right next to my backup computer, which somehow was unharmed. I mean, I am stunningly lucky. And all this happened because I decided to light a candle for some inspiration. And the reason I tell you this story, because what the heck does this have to do with van life, is because candles are evil. No, seriously. We live in the 21st century. You shouldn't be burning candles indoors in general, and you absolutely shouldn't be burning candles in a van. This is how fires happen. And I can imagine 100 different scenarios where I'd be in the van, it's nice and cozy, and let's light a candle, and maybe it'll give off a little bit of heat and help warm the van. No. And then something happens. The dog has to go for a walk, right? So you open the van door, and you decide not to close it all the way because you know you're going to be right back in with the dog. Then the dog sees a rabbit. You end up chasing the dog. You find out that, you know, you come back to the van half an hour later, and because you left the door a little bit open, there was a little wind coming in, and that blew the flame against the side of the candle, and the candle melted, and your van's on fire! I mean, anyway. Folks, I like candles. You might like candles, too. But they're not safe. Get yourself an LED candle, and if you are so addicted to candles that you're going to have one anyway, regardless of whatever I say, make sure the candle is, well, first off, it should be made out of soy, because they put themselves out as the wick goes down, but also make sure it's in a container of some sort. Just containerize that, because if I had used a candle that was in a container, it would have just stayed in the container, probably, unless it had broken the glass because it got too hot. That's a possibility too. So Yeah, folks, I am a very, very lucky person telling you this story, and I hope you can take something from this. Candles are bad. They really, really are not safe. They kill people every year. And heck, we got LED candles now. They're almost as cute. A place to visit. Actually, this is going to be kind of a combination here, but have you ever lost anything on an airplane? I mean, I have. I lost an old iPod. It actually had one of those stickers on it that said, if found, reward, and all that. Yeah, I never saw it again, but I was flying to Japan at the time, so I don't know that the person who found it read English or even know what to do with it. Anyway, lost a really nice iPod. And more recently, I lost my iPad. I had a really nice iPad Pro that I accidentally left on the plane. Realized it immediately, went to Delta and said, hey, I left it on the plane. They said there was nothing they could do. And believe it or not, I turned on Find My iPad, and it was in Vietnam, like 2 weeks later. So somebody actually stole that. Someone who either cleaned the plane or worked on the plane or something stole my iPad, and somehow it ended up in Vietnam. So sucks to be me, as they say. But sometimes when you leave stuff on the plane, the airline does try to get it back to you, but can't for some reason. And then what do they do with it? Well, they actually sell it, in many cases, to this company that collects it all, and then basically it's a resale shop for stuff found on airplanes. And it's a physical location. It's in Scottsville, Alabama, which is kind of halfway between Huntsville, Alabama, and Chattanooga, Tennessee. You know, not a big city, but it's there. And they have a whole store with all this stuff. And it's, you know, to me, okay, I mean, it's just stuff, right? I mean, of course, they've got a lot of AirPods. They've got a lot of jackets. They've got a lot of suitcases. You know, the stuff that obviously would get left behind. But you have to think here, every single one of these items has a story of some sort. All right, AirPods is a pretty easy story, right? You put them in your pocket, and they fell out and got left on the seat, and then you went home, and you're like, oh, darn, and then for some reason, you know, maybe the cleaning staff turned it into lost and found, but at that point, they didn't know what seat it was from. They just had no way to get it back to you, and so they went to the store. Okay, that's easy. A jacket, yeah, same thing. It's easy to leave a jacket in the overhead bin, and then they have no idea. Somebody on this plane lost this jacket. You know, they're not going to be able to find it. But some of the things are really quite extraordinary that they find. Now, the things I'm about to tell you about are not things that you're going to be able to buy at the store, but they are things that they have found. So one of the things they found was an aluminized fire suit. You know, it's the kind of suit you can wear actually in a fire. Yeah, somebody left that on a plane. They found a bear pelt back packed in salt. Apparently somebody went bear hunting and left their bear. A camera from the space shuttle, and I mean, there's only three of these things ever made, and they found one on a plane. Somebody was in trouble. They actually gave that one back to NASA, which was nice. An Egyptian burial mask, dated to 1500 BCE. That's interesting. And have you ever seen the movie Labyrinth? There is a character called Hoggle in that. It's an animatronic, kind of a little dwarfy kind of thing. And yeah, the one and only Hoggle, the original from the movie, somebody left on a plane. Very, very strange. So anyway, if you're ever in that region, maybe you're doing Natchez Trace or something like that, this could be a really fun place to visit and just see all the stuff. And now, the pricing is actually pretty good. And I have a list of the pricing, and you're going to find out why in about a second. And yeah, like AirPods are $120. Now, they're used, of course. They don't come with any packaging or warranty or anything. They take the electronics, and they clean them, and they make sure there's no personal information on them. But, you know, this is pretty much you get what you get. You don't actually know how good the stuff's going to be. But I want to go just to see the stuff and imagine the stories of, you know, how did this end up here? What was its journey? I like that kind of stuff. And that makes this turn into a resource recommendation. So if you can't get to Alabama, they also have the stuff available online. And it's on a very nice, easy-to-use website. It's not eBay or anything like that. It's just this nice website, and they basically list all the stuff, and you can buy it. And I was looking at the stuff, and like, you know, this is fairly attractive. There are MacBooks that are very reasonably priced and fairly recent. I mean, there's a 2023 here for like $500. A lot of iPads. A Kindle Fire that's normally $130 is only $62. Some weird things, too. A bucket of USB-C 2-in-1 charge cables. 40 of them is $45. That's really kind of weird. A mobile hotspot for Verizon, $12.99. Now, these hotspot devices actually cost a lot of money, so that's a pretty good deal. Of course, you're going to need to get service and stuff. A remote control for drones, a DJI remote control, RC231. It's the same controller that my drone uses, $50. Really not bad at all. So there's all kinds of stuff here. AirPods second generation with a wired case. This one doesn't have the battery case. You have to plug it in. But it's $39.99. So I don't know that this is the first place I'm going to think of when I want to buy something, but every once in a while, I will come and check this out because there's some cool stuff here. AirPods Max, you know, the big Apple metal headphones. I have a pair. They're not the greatest things in the world, but $300. That sounds like a lot, right? Well, they're $550 or more new. So, and this is the Lightning one, too. The new ones are USB-C, and do not buy the USB-C ones, by the way. You would think they would be better, but you can't plug them in and listen to the screens on airplane seats with the new ones. They just don't work. So if you wanted to watch a movie on the airplane with your headphones and it was an older system that didn't have Bluetooth, you can't, which is annoying. So anyway, I'll have a link in the show notes. It's just unclaimedbaggage.com, and they've got a lot of really cool stuff. And one thing I like, and I would probably buy one of these just because I'm a crazy person, five-piece USB charging block mystery box. So it's a box. It has five USB chargers in it. You have no idea what they're going to be. Yeah, I would probably buy that. Well, folks, thanks very much for listening to this episode 247 of Built to Go. Music, as always, by Simon Wagg. If you're looking to get a hold of me, heck, we've got a Discord server, we've got a Facebook group, and you can find those at builttogo.com. That's 2 T's, not 3, not 1. And if you need to email me, I'm jeff@builttogo.com. Until next time, remember the words of maybe Mark Twain, maybe not Mark Twain. Whiskey is for drinking. Water is for fighting.